Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Adam Francisco, and Dan Van Voris. We are on our sixth and final-ish episode of Christianity in America, because I have a feeling that we might come back to some of these topics.
So many of the stories do lend themselves to, you know, bigger discussions.
But, I mean, if you're just listening now, we went and started with the colonies, and we have worked our way forward through American history, following the church primarily through that, but also some of the social events that have, a lot of overlap with theological issues. And in this final episode, Dan's going to take us from World War II, basically, to the present. So,
let's we can do some definitions. I was thinking just now that I'd like a whiteboard, and I was reminded that when I was 21 years old, there was a Friday class, Religious Bodies in America. Rod, it was your class. It was a Friday, and you had to speak somewhere, and it was like a 2 or 3 o'clock class, and you said, no class, but Dan, if you want to kind of show, where all the churches go today, feel free. And a bunch of kids showed up on Friday, and I was just one of the students in the class, and I remember on the whiteboard just drawing all the trees with all the different religious, American church bodies. And so I feel kind of like we're doing that now. We're just looking who's where and who comes from where. I think it's helpful, but let's look at some definitions. Last time we did modernist and fundamentalist, and so that's a great way of understanding the first half of the 20th century. The second half gets a little messier, but the first word we want to look at is evangelical. There have been books after books after books published on what is an evangelical, but I think I've got a pretty good answer stolen from Mark Knoll. Mark Knoll says, on the whole, an evangelical is a pietist, Puritan, Presbyterian. Unpack it. Pietist in that they're spiritually self-oriented. Puritan in that they're morally strict. Presbyterians in that they've got their precisionism with their theology. And if you take those things together, that's an evangelical. And if you look at the roots of so many churches, Pietist, Puritan, Presbyterian, obviously a huge model. We saw in the last episode how fundamental they were. So that's, I love that definition. I think that's a really helpful definition for an evangelical. Now, the evangelical is kind of like the new fundamentalist, if we think of fundamentalist in that kind of 1910, 1915 mold, right? Doing historic Protestant Christianity, but usually outside of the historic confessions. It's just where the churches, the Bible churches, and the non-denominational churches are going. So the fundamentalist kind of ceases to exist as a term that people use about themselves, but it's a term that certainly is in the media and everywhere, right? Fundamentalist is a very common term. And the fundamentalist after World War II, think someone sort of who would call themselves politically, a conservative Christian, politically a member of the moral majority, where political is kind of the emphasis. That's where the fundamentalist goes in a way. But they're going to branch off a little from the evangelical. The other branch off is the charismatic Pentecostal movement. Now, that starts back in 1906 officially, and it starts in our backyard here in California. Yep, Azusa Street, the Azusa Street revivals. And the it picks up with Amy Semple McPherson and the Four Square Church. And the Four Square, that story, I'll come back. Please have me back. I will tell you the story of Sister Amy, which involves a fake kidnapping and, three different guys. I mean, it is, methamphetamine addiction. The denomination that changes the world because people like Chuck Smith and Bill Bright and all come out of the Four Square movement, which is a charismatic movement out of the Azusa Street revival.
That was the church up on the hill in the town that I grew up in. So like on this hill, the church on top, Foursquare Church.
When I lived in Los Angeles, I lived about three blocks away from Angelus Temple.
Yep,
that's it. That was where Sister Amy would drive her motorcycle up onto the stage, and people would just go crazy. I mean, it's...
Showmanship done really well.
And we see that in the tradition of the megachurch today, right? What you're seeing with the Joel Osteen, and like, that's just repackaged.
No message.
Just, well, I mean, there wasn't much... I would say the message for Sister Amy would be... very moralistic and very eschatological. Yeah. Right, those are eschatological.
Do you think those go together? Because if the end is coming, it's easier to scare people into
this
morality.
This is the 1970s. This is the way you keep kids. I mean, always, but this is the way. When I was growing up, you kept kids from doing naughty things. You told them Jesus is coming back real soon. I've done some math with the formation of Israel, and it's coming. So don't be caught, you know, with your pants down. And that is a huge eschatology.
Every Bible camp.
Yeah, every Bible. And the eschatology and a kind of moralism, really, those things, you know, come together. So that's that Pentecostal. And then the last one is what we refer to as mainline. Mainline are the heirs of modernism. Now, what they are they tend to be the historic church denominations that in the modernist break... The big churches, the churches with money, the churches in metropolitan areas, tended to go modernist. The churches that broke off, think OPC, they tended to go more conservative, fundamentalist, evangelical. The churches on the main lines in the Northeast were those churches that did not go fundamentalist, but were the churches with money in the metropolitan centers that embraced modernism. So mainline literally has to do with the train line that went by those churches that
which
were
affected the
richer,
economy and,
that have more money, were more progressive, and embraced modernism. So just a little bit of a, why is people always ask, why is it called mainline?
Uh-huh.
Literally because of trains. But the mainline, they're the heirs of modernism. So to use the Presbyterian Church again, the Presbyterian Church...
PCUSA.
PCUSA, which is part of the Northern Presbyterian Church in 1983, it all becomes PCUSA, that's mainline.
And us, ELCA.
ELCA is mainline, yeah. Methodists are funny because the main Methodists are mainline, but people, when they break off of Methodism, tend to just go their own way completely and don't need to keep the name Methodist anymore. So they're not a lot of those. So those are kind of the four. And the last time we were together, I hinted that the GI Bill has everything to do with the growth of a particular kind of American religion. And the GI Bill, of course, the... Adam, do you remember the real name of this? Service...
The Montgomery GI Bill?
The Service Adjustment Act.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Anyways, you could go, if you served, you could go to college. And this...
Still can, right? Yeah.
Sure, but I mean,
it was... You used to get a little check to go to college. Nowadays, it's pretty lucrative, but...
I know it was
beer money.
Well, back in the 50s and 60s, it was sending people on full rides to college.
Oh.
And if you look at the statistics of American colleges, the mess that American colleges are in today, it's because of the 1950s and 60s when we thought, everyone goes to college. Why? Because the government was paying for everyone to go to college. So if the government would like to continue to pay for everyone to go to college, then fine, keep the system. But it looks like it's starting to run dry. So we might want to think about a different model. But it comes right out of that. Now, whenever you have people, especially literate people, come together, crazy stuff happens. The Renaissance, the Reformation. I mean this. All of a sudden, you have these kind of centers of, you know, kind of elite culture in America. And they are the universities, right? And they're growing, and they're direct. People are coming from other parts of the country to them, and they're exchanging ideas. Sometimes progressive, sometimes conservative. But I'm talking 1950s, 1960s. A number of people in the church, especially a movement called Youth for Christ, thought we need to get in on this. If these are the new hubs of activity and young people, we need to be there. And so, Youth for Christ, most famously, has Billy Graham as an evangelist. Bill Bright starts Campus Crusade. InterVarsity is interesting because it's English
import.
Yeah, and there's InterVarsity and then InterVarsity Press, and they're going to come together. And if you look at evangelicalism, the second half of the 20th century, I mean, that's the story. The story is Campus Crusade, the story is the college ministries and the people that kind of came out of those college ministries. InterVarsity, Knowing God by J.I. Packer.
Yep.
All of Francis Schaeffer stuff.
All of Stott's stuff.
Yeah, John Stott. So it's the kind of high watermark of intellectual evangelicalism. Christianity Today, which started with Billy Graham and Youth for Christ and the first editor.
Was it L. Nelson Bell?
It may have been.
Ruth Graham's father?
It may have
medical
been.
Guy?
But it become. I mean, that is the... It's kind of tied with Fuller in some ways. Some of the same people. Mm-hmm. It's
writing for the magazine.
Yeah. McIntyre and others that sort of make their name. 1968 is when InterVarsity kind of takes off. I always kind of make that a time. James Sire. Probably a lot of people are familiar with his book, The Universe Next Door.
Yeah,
it's like a book
or
that,
Why Believe Anything at All.
Yeah, he was the first editor of InterVarsity Press. Mm. That gives you the kind of mindset. It was apologetic.
I served with him as a staff member in Southern California for quite a while.
Because, Rob, this is your background, these college ministries that shape evangelicalism.
Yep.
What ones did you particularly work with?
I was InterVarsity.
Okay.
I was most comfortable with it. Crusade was very excitable, but they didn't have an InterVarsity Press and didn't plan to.
Didn't have the intellectual sort of... Bill Bright is an interesting guy because...
And he came out of Foursquare.
He came out of Foursquare.
I had him at Hollywood First Press.
Yeah, his background is Foursquare.
Yo, no wonder there was a bird book.
Well, it's fascinating. And Bill Bright is really good friends with Bob Jones in the 50s. And Bob Jones...
Bob Jones University?
Bob Jones University, right? And Bob Jones says, listen, Bright, you're going liberal. You're hanging out with that Graham guy. Billy Graham, not our style. He's a modernist. He's a mainliner. Hmm. And Bright says, I'm going to go with Graham and not you. That's a huge moment in the difference between fundamentalism and a kind of charismatic fundamentalism that we see with Bob Jones, Oral Roberts, Jerry Falwell, and that kind of intellectual, which Bill Bright bent that direction. But Rod, they didn't have an InterVarsity Press.
Yep.
So they were more of a social club with theological roots than InterVarsity, which was...
Christianity is fun.
Yeah.
Your life will be better with Christ.
What does Lewis say? That if you're coming to it for fun, a glass of port can get you there faster?
That's when I first moved to Big Bear, there's a really small movie theater there, and before all the movies play, an advertisement for almost every single church in the valley rolls. So there's, you know, the Lutheran church, then the evangelical church. But the bigger non-denominational one up there, the big tagline that came across the screen, church doesn't have to be boring, church is fun. And I was like...
There it is.
Wow, that's on the nose.
Yes. There it is.
That's something else. Tell me it's under an hour, and I'll be there. So that's the only ad I need. I promise, less than an hour.
One of the ones that I suspect, but nobody's ever confirmed for me with regard to the mega churches, all sorts of disobedient sons can phone their mother and say, I went to church today.
Mm. Hey, yeah, for me, not growing up in the church, I went to church because the ladies were there. That was the place to go. What's his name? Sayyid Qutb in the 1950s criticizes Christianity as Muslim guy because youth groups are just these wild places where there's orgies.
Yeah.
They're just dancing.
Bottle.
Yeah.
Spin the bottle at youth group.
The other thing, so we look at Bill Bright and Billy Graham and those movements, another Foursquare guy, just how big Foursquare was, right in our backyard, too, Chuck Smith.
Yep.
And Chuck Smith in the 1960s is, you know, a charismatic Foursquare guy with a moralistic bent. And at the same time, he's got the sort of, the evangelicals have a kind of outward missions focus that comes from the mid-19th century and Chinese missions and Hudson Taylor and the big names you hear there. And so quite laudable, he decides, I'm going to take the church to these people. And so he does. And there are all sorts of stories about the founding, and the story of Lonnie Frisbee is worth its weight in gold. Lonnie Frisbee is the first Jesus freak.
You know more about this stuff than any human being I know.
Here's the thing. He came out as homosexual in the 80s, and he was written out of the history. Go to the Calvary Chapel home history site and see if Lonnie Frisbee is there. He was the original guy.
Wow,
and
really?
Gone. Yeah. So it's, what's worth that? What's interesting with Calvary Chapel is not only do they become that kind of four-square theology with heavy evangelism emphasis, there's a fight over how charismatic they want to be. And the evangelicals are going to have this battle in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And in 82, Calvary Chapel splits. John Wimber, who was one of the heads of Calvary Chapel, forms the Vineyard Church.
Yep.
And Calvary Chapel essentially then becomes a denomination and starts spreading out with, you know, franchises all across America. Now, Adam, I think I heard a rumor that you went to a Vineyard Church for a while. Tell us about what is the Vineyard Church?
Well, actually, I started in a four-square church.
It's everybody's story.
And it must have been, this would have been in the 90s, mid-90s. It must have been around the things were when things were splitting, because some of the Hope Chapels, these were the four-square churches in Hawaii where I was, some were going more in the Calvary Chapel direction, and others were bringing in, I think they were called the Kansas City Prophets, and these other these traveling charismatic people who would prophesy and heal and so on and so forth. And some of the pastors were heavily influenced by the Vineyard, and that was my entry. In 1997-ish, I guess, I went to a Vineyard conference in Anaheim and was, I'm going to put air quotes around it, slain in the spirit by John Wimber. I mean, actually, because, it was kind of pushed over, but...
But that element, right, it's it comes out of the early evangelical, comes out of the Wesley tradition, but comes out of... But it's peculiar, in a peculiar way, American, that that sort of individual experience is necessary. And so necessary that it's going to become a sine qua non of your salvation. Were you slain in the spirit? Did you speak in tongues?
Yeah.
Did you ever speak in tongues, Adam?
I was coached how to speak in tongues, but it never really took.
Yeah,
I always felt weird.
It's in 97. Is that you ended up Concordia really shortly after?
Yeah, yeah.
I'll tell you,
and
it was.
There's a person who's maybe sitting at this table that kind of convinced me that that was silly.
You know, it's funny that that movement kind of died. The Kansas City Prophet. I mean, it's still around the kind of take your money TBN stuff, but they've had so many legal troubles that they're not. They don't make as much. Noise as they used to. But the book that introduced me to that was a book called Power Religion. Yeah. And Rod, you have a chapter in Power Religion. It was edited by Mike Horton. And it really looks at this weird thing in the 80s and 90s that that book kind of puts its thumb on and says, this is what's wrong with this. And so if that's something, so if you are TBN inclined or have given money to Creflo Dollar or
700 Club,
check that book out, because I think it's a really easy way to kind of compare what's going on.
My great-grandmother, I mean, most of the time I can remember coming over to her house, she was sitting in her recliner, and TBN was on.
We had a lady give $9 million to one of those charismatic groups, and one of our guys in the ALC decided to visit her and ask her why the church she attended that she gave nothing to. And she said, well, Robert Shuler gave me a personal letter, signed personal letter from him. And, of course, it was auto-done.
Yeah.
But she didn't know that. And the guy didn't reply. He just thanked her for her time.
This movement gets so sort of grossly decadent. And it really hits its peak in the 80s. The high water mark is Pat Robertson running for president, right? Because they got... With Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority and the charismatic TBN and Jim Baker, they all got together. And the high watermark was they were going to put one of their guys in the White House. And so in 87, Pat Robertson at the Iowa caucus came in third place. Now, that doesn't seem like much, but that's big news, right? Iowa caucus is what everyone's gunning for. It's the first one. And to come in third, you're saying I'm on the map. Now, of course, like so many presidential candidates, he faded. But that was the moment when people thought, this is bigger than we thought.
Yeah.
There are more people who have this. However, the church went through so many scandals, think Swaggart, think the Bakers, that the style became unpopular. And so there needed to be something, what else could we do? Okay, that style doesn't work, but we need something new, something flashy. Well, Calvary Chapel's working, and Hope Chapel and Vineyard. And then also, in 1979. A little house church meets in the Saddleback Valley here in Lake Forest, California, and that becomes Saddleback Church, and that's the next big thing, right? That's the 2000s, 2010s. It's the mega church. It's the new way of entertaining. It's Charles Finney.
Sure.
It's Second Great Awakening stuff.
Sure.
It's just happening again.
Yep.
And so it's an interesting thing to kind of see, you know, where it's come. Just look definitionally and who's who in the zoo. I think it can be helpful.
Didn't Fuller Seminary become sort of, at least our School of World Missions, become sort of a theological anchor to the charismatic movement with C. Peter Wagner.
Yes. That. Peter Wagner, who was a world missions guy and was into...
I mean, they really popularized the charismatic theology. The charismatic theology became fairly mainstream, I think, at that point.
Both Sproul and I had chapters in the charismatic movement and had to think our way through it and out of it.
Yeah.
I was surprised when R.C. told me that because I knew I had to.
What was your...
It was Father Dennis Bennett, the... from the Valley, Episcopal priest, and had some kind of charismatic experience, and then went up to Ballard, Washington, and there I walked in to hear his Friday night lecture on the charismatic movement and why. He was a University of Chicago grad, you know, no dummy. But the place where it really, really, you have to think about it is the Doctrine and Revelation. Because it's continuing revelation. Whatever the list in 1 Corinthians means, they were taking that in a particular way. So the canon wasn't closed. And then I'd ask questions about what's the difference between somebody with a gift of prophecy or knowledge and Holy Scripture, and they couldn't answer it.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the Protestant cry, the sola scriptura, is one of the first things to go.
Yep.
And it leaves us, we've seen in the history of 500 years of the Protestant church, we see it slip out in all sorts of different ways. But sola scriptura can leave because of a charismatic person with a new word.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right? It can be a best-selling author, and that book becomes, as Rod used to tell us, the book in your left hand. And if you've got to come with two Bibles, that's how you know you're a cult. Right? And that kind of, and it's very American, right? It's the cult of the celebrity. It's the market where you too can be. I'm staring at a picture of Elvis right now.
Right.
Here's the thing. I too can wear those kinds of shorts if I only, you know, buy this record or something or work out. Mm-hmm. It's all built for us. And so why would we expect the churches to be any different unless the church is saying we're particularly out of time and we're going to do something that looks countercultural. And one of the things that we're finding is that's where people are going. And I think that's encouraging. The thing that I said we'd make available, I have some charts that I brought in, just real basic, just to say, here's where things are going. And what's interesting is people are becoming unaffiliated faster than anything else. They are what we call religious nuns. N-O-N-E-S, yeah. And that's the fastest growing group in Christianity. In America. And I mean, in some ways you could say that's ripe for the picking, right? How many churches are starting? How many mega churches found? And was it last week or a couple weeks ago? I think Scott brought up the fact that while all these mega churches were booming, the percentage of people who claimed they were Christian stayed the same.
Yeah.
People were just moving from one church. Yeah. You're just shuffling the chairs, right? Mm-hmm. But the people that are leaving those now, the mega churches, the main lines, those are the ones that are going down. And so I think it's worth looking at that. And maybe it's too close to us to make many comments about what we're going to call this period, because it's strange.
Well, orthodoxy is now countercultural.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. We're seeing people go to...
It's chic.
Yeah.
Almost.
Yeah, and we're seeing, I mean, High church is popular with people.
Yeah.
I mean, people are looking for something that looks out of time.
Yep.
And it just so happens we have a tradition that looks 16th century-ish.
Yep.
But anything that takes you out of time is going to help get you sort of your bearings set so that you're not just thinking about, you know, whatever it is, the rock band or what have you. So,
but just as much can be, you know, about the experience of it, right? So maybe... people aren't flooding to it because, oh, these people actually believe in the truth of resurrection or something, but for the visual style, do you think that's
part of it too? Or? I just read one this morning on the Federalist, Molly Hemingway, the editor, and it was an appeal to get rid of your screens in your church.
There was a...
Just this morning.
There was a Babylon Bee article, and it was Innovative Church prints out the whole service in books instead of, you know, when the screen broke. There's an article, Caleb, I'm going to have it linked to you.
All right, cool.
From Cracked, which is, I think, a very funny website, but also very poignant in some ways. And it's an article from someone who left the church called Things You Lose When You Leave the Church.
Mm-hmm. There was a book on it called Exit Interviews.
Yeah, I mean this... and
Gertig was one of the ones they interviewed.
I can say this just to plug something else. Soul of Christianity, which, Rod, you were on the first season of, which we did the Apostles' Creed. The second season of Soul of Christianity, Debbie and I are recording right now, and it's interviews with people who have left the church.
Yep.
And I think that's, you know, not only are the religious nuns the biggest religious change, nuns in general are the biggest change when it comes to what people are moving towards. Not that they're in the majority or plurality, but the change percentage is higher than anything else. Religious nuns, people who have walked away, the sad or the mad alumni. Mm.
The religious nuns who, so the... they presumably, with the word religious tag on, still believe in something. They just, they don't abandon it all. Is that the idea?
I'm gonna go back to...
they check the box that says none when, in terms of religious affiliation.
Yeah.
That's why they get the term, and they're spiritual but not religious. They're all across the board. I don't think you can really... pigeonhole.
Yeah, the thing is they won't click anything else. So it's not like everyone's leaving for Buddhism.
Right.
It's not like everyone is leaving for Unitarianism. Or something. Right. They're leaving and saying, I don't know.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens.
And interestingly, around the globe though, what is growing quite rapidly, like in China, Africa?
Yep.
Christianity, but a particular charismatic or Pentecostal flavor
America. That has been the case. Now there's a connection between Pentecostalism and the poor. And I want to tread lightly here, but there's a socioeconomic thing. Wherever it grows, Azusa, wherever it grows with people who are down on their luck, right? The now not yet eschatology, forget the not yet. I need it now because I'm broke.
Right.
And so when you need the now, the charismatics bring you the now quickest.
Yep.
And so the charismatics go into China, go into Africa, go into these places and say, we're going to change your life now. It's tragic. That we've lost the not yet.
Well, and they have some guts. I mean, these Assemblies of God missionaries, they will just go to Iran. Oftentimes they go missing then, but they just have a lot. I mean, trying to put the best construction on it.
Yeah, right? Sure.
A lot of courage to. They just well, that's, go it's a, and. But yeah, they're spreading an odd, not historic, not Orthodox version of Christianity, but it is growing quite rapidly, at least the stuff that I've read recently.
You know what I've wondered about on that subject? Whether, when the churches aren't fulfilling their commission, whether China would evangelize Africa. Huh. They've been through the suffering. Uh-huh. They believe the historic gospel, and there are zillions of them.
So maybe it's time, because we have such a peculiar history, because our past is so intertwined with all this stuff, maybe it's going to take someone in a different context to speak to a different people in a way that we comfortable hot shower taking people
don't understand. It's like in the Anglican Church, Anglican Mission in America, I think is the denomination, small, and it's Anglicans from Africa coming to England and America to preach the gospel to us.
Yeah, and to ball out the bishops here. What you,
to be sure, yeah.
You know, since you haven't done it, we're going to do it. And particularly Episcopal congregations here in America will be ordained through some Orthodox bishop in Africa because the mainline Episcopal church in this country is... nowhere.
Yeah. Worse than John Shelby Spong now, which is hard to imagine.
Yes.
I mean, they just believe nothing.
Yep.
Yeah, Spong, I mean, that's if you want to look at sort of the decadence of modernism and mainline liberalism, and I mean, Bishop Spong is sort of the end goal of silliness.
Yep.
And I say that respectfully, I guess. I mean, it's just, it's so goofy in that it's trying, it's like, are you an Enlightenment fellow? You just think everything works like it's a, you know, a grid, a matrix, and you can just draw. I mean, it really is. It's modernist silliness.
So then the next set of charts is pretty interesting to me. It's a projected set of charts here.
Yeah.
About the number of people who will be, basically, the Christian and Muslim is the big one on here, two biggest religions in the world, presumably, based on what I'm seeing here. I think that's right, right? They are?
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I was just, where was I the other day? I was at the Aquarium of the Pacific in Long Beach, and they opened up a new theater that's quite beautiful, but the video in the theater was how we're all doomed, basically, because there's going to be 10 billion people by 2050.
All right, so they've been reading some Malthus and decided to scare the kids with it.
That's exactly what they did. So this was interesting to me here, because between the number of Christians projected in 2050 that they have on what you supplied is 2.92 billion, and the Muslims is 2.76. So it still has half of the projected Earth's population as one of these
two
religions.
Yeah.
And some estimates suggest that by 2050, your chart here ends at 2050, it'll be 3.1 million or billion Muslims. So who knows?
Well, it's interesting. One thing you see with this is that in the past chart, whenever you cut up denominations and say who's what, where, is that we are no longer in the majority. Mm. We might no longer be in the plurality, because historic Christianity, you know, it's outdone by the people that can give you more of the now than the not yet. And when we look globally, I mean, it really does put us, I think, in our place to say, wow, we've, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are kind of ripe for, you know, for talking about this kind of thing, you know, and
well, what these tell you too, I mean, because the numbers are so large, I mean, they have the current was, when this survey was taken, was 2.17 billion Christians. Mm-hmm. So religion, number one, is not going anywhere. And also, the United States is clearly not the center of the religious world, because there's nowhere near 2.7 billion of us.
It's Africa, it's China, it's other places that... you know, maybe they'll someday start sending missionaries to us.
Bibliographical reference, Philip Jenkins, his book, The Coming Christendom and Different Christianity or something like that. He's got a whole bunch. He's from University of Pennsylvania. He's doing all the documentation and writing on this, telling a story of Christianity in the past and in present and in the future that just has been off our radar, because we've been so, I don't use this term ever, but so... ethnocentric, I think, might be the anthropological term, where we focus on ourselves rather than looking at the global.
Yeah, whatever our tribe happens to be. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, our tribe in America was American. Mm-hmm. Right? And you were an American and a Christian, and we'll see which one you give more weight to. And that's the story. Now, today, we become a little more tribal, and we define ourselves in little different ways. We've got a million denominations. Now, denominations aren't even enough. We've just got our own independent, you know.
Well, in our past.
In our own church, the cuts in foreign missions have been draconian.
Yeah.
That's all. It's like the Democrats always dipping into the money for the military to fund something social. My own church, our own church nationally, dips into its foreign missions first, not second, not third, not fourth. The money is transferred first from foreign missions
to fund other projects.
And that is, you know, in the LCMS, tragic. I've heard the stories of people's lives being just kind of crushed by bureaucracy that says missions,
Yep.
I mean, missions in America is gigantic, right? From 1850 on. I mean, it's part of the best of evangelicalism.
Yep.
And the LCMS has had really interesting presence in China and Japan that I've witnessed, and now they're going away. Right?
Yep.
They're cutting at it.
When I was with InterVarsity, the way of doing foreign missions was foreigners who were at our universities.
Huh.
The world has come to you.
Yeah.
You don't have to go to it. It's here in their children who are attending your university.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard that before, you know, with Christian universities whose student population becomes majoritively not whatever that denomination is, or even in some cases majoritively not Christian, and it's then talked about as an evangelism opportunity.
But we don't know how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Besides requiring people to take classes in theology or something.
And go to chapel or be encouraged.
It's hard to evangelize. It's hard to evangelize feelings.
Yeah.
You can do it if you're in a college and you require chapel attendance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can do that. You can make everyone sort of feel the vibe by, you know, amping up the bass or what have you. But outside of that, it's hard. It's impossible. You got to have something to actually have.
You know the one I wonder about? Once a country has been thoroughly or well evangelized and drifts away from it, can they ever be brought back? And I don't know the answer.
Huh. Sort of like that Hebrews verse on a national level.
Yeah.
If you've fallen away once, good luck coming back.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, speaking of, you know, missions being this grand thing, I will say I was watching a documentary a while back, not religious at all, but it had something to do with, it was in Africa and there was a church and it was African church and it did not look like our church. It was them doing. And when you listen to the tune, what tune is that? Oh, Shine Jesus Shine. Look what we exported. And we've got to be careful with that, right? Missions also became a cheap way for people to travel.
Yeah.
Right. And that's
tourism, just tourism.
Exactly.
Is,
yeah. Mean. Poverty tourism. and I think that's sort of the dark side of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one thing to look at when we're looking historically is to realize that every generation falls into certain traps. Every generation that we've looked at has, wrung their hands and said, woe is me, it's never been worse.
Mm.
Right? There's always the people who say, hey, we're going downhill. There are, I would say, always the anti-supernaturalists. You're going to find them in Enlightenment, you're going to find them in modernism, and that's just a big thing you're going to want to look for. You're going to look for supernaturalists, which we've talked about is oftentimes the best of the fundamentalist and evangelical. And then one more group that we're going to add in the second half is the hyper-spiritual. The hyper-spiritual, the one who is not just happy with revelation in a book, but an extra source of revelation. And that can be emotion. That can be a text from a new religious movement. It can be all number of things. But the problem isn't that they don't believe in miracles. The problem is they don't believe enough. It's that they believe too much, that they believe everything.
Yeah.
So once again, you know, the modernist, I would say that, you know, and you guys can fill me in, but modernism and strict atheism doesn't seem to be something I run into that much.
No.
It's more someone who's just sort of a general skeptic, or someone who just kind of believes whatever, or I don't know the numbers
on that. Well, the schools are producing more and more and more of it. The public, what we used to call the public schools, and then continue on through college.
So the idea of atheists or just nuns.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wonder about the sort of hard-boiled atheist, the Dawkins. I mean, does that kind of person who says God does not exist and I can prove it,
is there a lot of that?
That doesn't seem like a very big... It seems more everything goes.
It seems a flash in a pan about 10 years ago, and now it's just dying.
Yeah. But we see these same things, right? An anti-supernatural or a hyper-spiritual, sola scriptura plus, or the scripture plus. Mm. That's the way we go. And I could take you through a million outlines, and if we're looking at the American church, that's where I'm going to take you.
Yeah.
And it'll look different in the Lutheran church. Let me say, on Let the Bird Fly, it's a podcast on our 1517
network. Yep.
They have a podcast on the history of American Lutheranism with a guy who I just thought was brilliant. It was a guest they had.
Mm-hmm. That was just a recent episode.
Just recent. And I listened to it and thought, "Pooh, all right, in 1 hour, you just did what would take me 10. So give that a listen. I think that'll kind
I'll
of
put
the Lutheran church in the context of what we've been talking. But once again, you'll find anti-supernatural, supernatural, and the hyper-spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
It's how we roll in America.
Well, cool, Dan. Well, hey, thanks for being on the show. Is there anything else you wanna plug or say?
Yeah, well, the Christian History Almanac is something that I'm doing right now, and it's based on an old kind of almanac model where it's what happened on this day, fun stories. I actually write out the story so that it's not just this happened, but here's why this is important or interesting. And then I end with a piece of prose or something that is evocative. Today on the show, I ended with the last paragraph of The Last Battle from C.S. Lewis, which is just, listen for that alone.
Oh.
But if you have any favorites, if you have a quote by someone and you say, oh, I love this, or I love this poem, or I love this reading, I did Capon a little while back, send it to me danv@1517.org. But check out the Almanac. That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing these days.
Fastest growing podcast we have ever had on at 1517. So
it's been fun to watch it grow. So if you could check it out, give it a rating.
I want to recommend the close of Pilgrim's Progress.
Ah,
when he's crossed the river, it comes out the other side.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
Rod, do you remember the first class I ever took with you? You recited a poem. Do you know what poem that would be?
20 years ago.
Well, there was one to my father I often did. That was MacDonald.
MacDonald?
To my father.
To my father? Okay, I'll look that up. So I remember one of my first memories of Concordia. Anyways, well, thanks, great. Guys. Thanks for having me. Thanks for letting me hang out here on The Thinking Fellows.
Yeah, no, you are you're a bona fide host now.
All right. The fifth Beatle. I'll take it.
So, it's been a lot of fun. I hope people have enjoyed this. If you have questions that you can feel free to email them to The Thinking Fellows. We have, if you go to our website, there's an email form there. There's also an email form on the 1517 website that gets directed to me as well, and I can pass it on to the guys if it's a relevant question. And as always, thank you. Every episode in this series, I've done sort of a short ask for donations at the end of this episode, and I just want to say thank you to all of the supporters who have made The Thinking Fellows possible, who made Christian History Almanac possible.
Real fast, the 1517 Academy. I've got to say something.
Yes,
about that.
Yes, do it. Go for it.
Check it out. That's where we're trying to get all this stuff. We've got classes from Rod, classes from Adam. Class from Chad Bird on the Old Testament. I do Reformation. We're going to be doing a class on Christianity in America for the 1517 Academy,
yep,
which will be kind of a live class of me.
In the
kind
Academy,
of doing this stuff a little bit with deeper, you know, sort of hour-long lectures and the like. The Academy is something that has been just, that's another thing that's been growing. And
again, all of this is free. I mean, that's one of the big things we've been able to do here is we make...
resources,
quality education and resources for the church, free. And the only way we've been able to do that is by kind support. So if you are a donor, thank you. If you're considering donating and supporting us, again, it's 1517.org/give, or you can just go to 1517.org and there's a donate button in the right hand corner. All right, thank you so much. We'll catch you next time. Bye.